Today is Friday, June 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, is the U.S. heading for war after Iran shoots down an American drone?
The president may not intend to go to war here, but we're worried that he and the administration may bumble into a war.
A mixed blessing for Europe as it struggles with an over-tourism problem. Also ahead, a never-before-heard song from Queen frontman Freddie Mercury has just been released. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump Thursday called Iran's shoot down of a U.S. drone over the Strait of Hormuz a very bad mistake, saying it will further complicate an already tense showdown between Washington and Tehran. Earlier in the day, Iran's Revolutionary Guard claimed to have shot down the U.S. RQ-4 Global Hawk drone over Iranian airspace. But U.S. Central Command, which oversees U.S. military activity in the region, quickly refuted Iran's claim, saying an unprovoked attack on a U.S. surveillance asset was in international airspace. A top State Department official is assuring Congress that the U.S. is not seeking war with Iran, but congressional Democrats worry that escalating tensions with the Islamic Republic will give the Trump administration an excuse to enter into a military conflict. And they warn that President Trump must respect Congress's constitutional power to declare war. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has details.
Growing tensions in the Gulf, sparking new arguments on Capitol Hill. Iranian provocations are the result of President Trump withdrawing from the 2015 nuclear agreement, say Democrats.
That this was eminently predictable. In fact, that the intelligence could have and did warn of exactly these kind of increased risks of conflict with Iran if we pursued the course that we have been pursuing for the last 2 years.
But Iranian aggression is a sign the Trump administration's tough sanctions policy is working, Republicans said.
And what the administration's doing effectively, correctly, is increasing the maximum pressure on them, keeping the maximum pressure campaign going. And it's very important that we do that. It's very important that the Iranians recognize and understand that we will defend freedom of navigation, that we'll defend the Straits of Hormuz, we'll defend our interests and the interests of our allies.
The hope is for peace, a State Department diplomat told lawmakers.
We have put the possibility of a much brighter future on the table for the Iranian people, and we mean it. The comprehensive deal we seek with the Iranian regime should address four key areas: its nuclear program, its ballistic missile development and proliferation, its lethal support and financial support to terrorist groups and proxies, and its arbitrary detention of U.S. citizens.
But with the deployment of 1,000 U.S. troops to the Middle East, the administration is signaling all options, including military force, are still available. This worries Democrats.
Rather than force Iran back to the negotiating table, the administration's policy is increasing the chances of miscalculation, which then would bring the United States and Iran closer to a military conflict.
A conflict Democrats say only Congress has the power to authorize.
If the administration sees a threat that requires military force against Iran, your first step is right here on Capitol Hill. There is no law, no aging authorization from another conflict, that's the 2001 AUMF, that could apply to war against Iran. The administration would need prior authorization from Congress before going to war.
Passed just days after the September 11th terrorist attacks, the AUMF is an 18-year-old statute authorizing military action against the Taliban and al-Qaeda.
The 2001 AUMF is worded very broadly. It says essentially that the president is authorized to use military force against anyone he determines. So there is this deferential element of it to have assisted or harbored the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks.
Democrats say the administration's claim of linkage between al-Qaeda and Iran isn't strong enough to subvert congressional authority, setting up the potential for yet another constitutional conflict between the branches of the U.S. government. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un welcomed Chinese President Xi Jinping to Pyongyang Thursday in what's being touted as a historic visit given an uneasy alliance. Kim has made four visits to Beijing in recent months. Xi's visit to Pyongyang comes ahead of the Group of 20 meeting to be held in Japan. International Edition's Steve Miller spoke with Jenny Town, managing editor of Stimson's 38 North, a website providing analysis on North Korea. And he asks her why she thinks the meeting is happening at this moment in time.
It is a good question. Certainly there was expectation that she would go to Pyongyang last year, and there was at least one planned visit that was postponed. So I don't think it's surprising that he's popped up in Pyongyang and is willing to go. The timing, you know, does align with an important China-North Korea holiday, celebrating their or commemorating their the long-standing bilateral relationship. I think the acceptance to go, knowing that it's a week before the G20 summit as well, probably is a secondary factor in this, and sort of an added bonus for Xi to be able to carry messages to President Trump as well, if there's something to be said to help get the process moving, the USCPRK negotiation process back on track.
You mentioned the stalled talks between Washington and Pyongyang, but also Beijing and Washington are in the middle of trade disputes with tariffs going back and forth between the two governments. Since Xi and Kim said they were going to discuss important regional issues during their two-day summit, what realistically can either really achieve to move their respective agendas forward in such a short meeting?
I don't expect too much. Certainly they will talk about the negotiation process. I think the Chinese really want to make sure that the North Koreans stay engaged and, you know, but are still sympathetic to the concept that any kind of denuclearization process has to be phased and has to deal also with North Korea's strategic interests and their security concerns. I think similar to, you know, the Putin-Kim summit, but North Korea is, you know, leaning on it relatively sympathetic voices, although both China and Russia are, you know, also want North Korea to go down that denuclearization road. I think there might also be some level of competition going on, you know, between China and Russia to maintain some competition for influence in the region and trying to ensure that, you know, China's influence still is higher than that of Russia. I do think, too, there's also a bit of a message to President Moon here as well, again, sort of underscoring how much the credibility of Moon has really eroded in North Korea for Kim Jong-un as well, with Moon being unable to move forward with the inter-Korean agenda because he's not getting cooperation from the United States.
Is there anything else you think we should be watching out for as day two of the Kim-Xi summit gets underway on Friday?
I think it'd be really interesting to see how the media covers it. It was, of course, very unusual for them to talk about the visit before it happened, especially unusual for them to actually publish, you know, an editorial by Xi Jinping in advance of the conference as well. It's not unusual for Xi Jinping to do such an editorial before making a state visit. But it's a new response from North Korea to actually promote it in such a way. And I think it's very similar to when Kim Jong-un allowed Moon Jae-in to address the Supreme People's Assembly as well, that, you know, he's willing to do things a little bit different if it helps support and help build support domestically for the agenda that he wants to pursue.
All right. That is Jenny Town, managing editor of Stimson's 38 North, speaking with VOA colleague Steve Miller. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. President Trump predicts passage of a trade deal with Canada and Mexico. The U.S. says Saudi Arabia and Cuba are among the world's worst in fighting human trafficking. A watchdog group accuses Ivanka Trump of political ethics violations. And refugee children head broken families in Ugandan camps. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. In the UK, the Conservative Party held another round of votes for candidates vying to become Britain's next prime minister. The battle could determine under what conditions Britain leaves the European Union, with Brexit currently scheduled for October 31st. And it comes as Britain's Treasury chief is warning that leaving the European Union without a deal would damage the economy and ultimately risk the breakup of the UK. Joining us to discuss is London-based reporter Amy Gutman. So, Amy, what exactly happened on Thursday?
It was the final round of two votes. We had one in the morning and one in the evening. This was the final round to eliminate all the Conservative Party candidates for the leadership of the party and bring the final race down to just two. So the two remaining candidates are the front runner by a long shot, Boris Johnson. He's, of course, he's a controversial pro-Brexit politician. He served two terms as London mayor, and he's also the former foreign secretary. Now opposing him is Jeremy Hunt, who made it to second place by just two votes, beating Michael Gove. It was a very tight race with a lot of animosity within the party over this. And Jeremy Hunt is the current foreign secretary. Both Boris and Jeremy have good pedigrees, but at the moment, there's a big gap between the two in terms of votes.
So, well, then what happens next?
There's going to be a televised debate and 16 town hall events for party members where both candidates will go head-to-head on the issues. Most likely, those 16 town hall events will be spread out over the next 4 weeks, so four different town halls per week all over the UK, culminating in a postal vote. So this will be a mail-in ballot where all of the members of the Conservative Party, so not just the MPs, until now it's been only the MPs who've had a vote. So the entire party will now get their vote through this mail-in ballot. And then the announcement of the winner will take place the week of July 22nd. Now, why are they saying the week of and not a specific date? Because they don't know when they'll have all the ballots counted. Some are speculating that people have already made up their minds and that they will be mailing in their vote the minute they receive the ballot. And so it's possible we could hear quite early in that week, but it will definitely be on July 22nd. And whoever wins will, of course, replace Theresa May as prime minister and also be tasked with handling Brexit.
So is there any clear front runner? Who are people thinking is likely to win?
Well, Jeremy Hunt is fairly well liked, whereas Boris is a very divisive figure. But Boris Johnson has a very wide lead. He has from the start, and many people have already made up their minds. It's one of those situations where often the pack mentality is to simply go behind the person they think is going to win. And so it does seem to be the case that a lot of people have made up their minds. On the other hand, other people are speculating that while it's true most of the Conservative Party MPs are behind Boris because they believe he's electable and he has the power to keep the Conservative Party in power, it's less certain among the wider Conservative Party. You know, often what the politicians think can be very different from the way their constituents think. We've seen this before. We saw this in the U.S. with the last election, where the way people vote isn't necessarily how they say they're going to vote. They get that ballot in their hands, and sometimes they make a different decision. So Boris is seen as the pro-Brexit candidate who will lead the U.K. out of Brexit come what may, while Jeremy Hunt is seen as being far more conciliatory out of the two, to the point where some have even wondered whether he might delay Brexit further. Boris is more combative and not well-liked in Brussels, but it's said that he definitely intends to pursue a deal with the EU rather than crash out, which is what's been speculated. Those who believe that Boris will lead the UK out of Brexit, and most likely with a deal, are probably going to vote for him, whereas others who may not be as pro-Brexit will likely vote for Jeremy Hunt.
All right. London-based reporter Amy Gutman, I am sure you will continue to keep us up to date. Well, the summer tourism season in Europe hasn't even hit peak yet, and already it is exploding beyond capacity. At popular cities and landmarks and even some up-and-coming locations, the crowds and their cameras are overwhelming residents and businesses and making some of these quaint cities feel more like lines at Disneyland. In the Croatian city of Dubrovnik, featured as King's Landing in Game of Thrones, it saw a 53% rise in tourists in the first 3 months of this year. Some locations are now taking unusual steps to curb the number of visitors. Joining us to talk about this is Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Catherine, sounds like too much of a good thing.
Indeed, you're having some of these, really these old medieval cities across Europe suddenly realizing that this explosion of tourists, of mass tourism, is not the great solve-all solution that they thought was going to be there. You've got cities such as Bruges in Belgium, where they're now having to limit the number of cruise ships that come around each day. They're going to reduce that from 5 down to 2 coming into the nearest port. They're going to also limit what days of the week these can come in. Now, the reason for this is you have a city like Bruges. They get something like 8.3 million tourists a year, but only 2.5 million of them stay overnight. So you're getting, wow, just all these cruise ship passengers coming in. They walk around, buy a few trinkets, and then they leave again. So the town is under enormous strain for infrastructure to supply this. But in fact, it brings no real value to the town because the people aren't staying in hotels. They're not going to restaurants overnight. Then you get other similar cities, such as Dubrovnik on the Adriatic Sea, Croatia. This year, they had 101,000 tourists come in. Now, that's more than 50% increase on last year. Again, you've got a small town, a walled city, and you've just got these cruise ships coming into port, people coming out. So what cities are starting to have to do is say, well, we're going to have to limit cruise ships, we're going to have to limit tourists, and we're going to have to figure out a way of taxing tourists who come to towns but don't spend much money.
I would imagine, though, that it's sort of a mixed blessing because obviously tourism brings in money. So it's sort of one of those sort of a good problem to have, but not really, but too much of a good thing.
When you look at a city like Venice in northern Italy, complete over-tourism. You take, for example, you're having something like 32,000 cruise ship passengers coming ashore every day at the height of the season and wandering around the streets on those islands. And you put on top of that, you've got some 460,000 day trippers coming from elsewhere in Italy. That's a lot of over-tourism. Now, those people aren't necessarily going to buy anything, so they're just going to be there. And that's why Venice, the city of Venice, has imposed a tax. They're going to bring in an entry fee for people who just come in on a day basis. What the particular industry officials are saying is that what they've got to do, these towns, particularly these big tourism towns, they've got to start attracting high quality tourism, and they've got to attract people to come outside of the high season. That means making sure there's something for tourists, not just in July and August, but also in, say, May and June, and also September and October. Because the number of tourists worldwide is enormous. We're talking about 1.4 billion people go on holiday annually, and around half of them come to Europe. So that's a lot of people wandering around very small cities that just weren't built for mass tourism.
I can't help but think that it would take away from their, you know, ambiance, the feeling that those cities are meant to have when you see hundreds of people with selfie sticks in these historic cobblestone streets.
Indeed. And you take, for example, here in Paris, the Louvre Museum. Workers there went on strike one day recently because they said there's just so many tourists with their selfie sticks in front of the Mona Lisa that anyone who's in the room with the Mona Lisa, chances are they won't see it because there's all these selfie sticks being waved around in front of the actual work of art itself. So, yes, there is a real problem. And the European Union has actually come up with a list of some 105 European cities that are struggling with this over-tourism. And it's not just the ones you expect, like Venice or Paris, Barcelona. You're also looking at places even further north, Dublin, Copenhagen, these sorts of places that start becoming more attractive now that climate change is coming in and people really don't want to go to these hot, crowded places around the Mediterranean.
All right, that is Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. It may be hard to believe that in modern-day America, not everybody has access to high-speed internet, but that's the reality for many Americans, especially those in rural areas of the country. VOA's Julie Tabot traveled to the southern region of the state of West Virginia to learn how lack of connectivity is affecting members of a farming community.
James Cyphers is an unlikely beekeeper.
Amazing how they build that up that perfect and that quick.
After leaving the military, he worked in construction, then as a coal miner for 16 years. But when the mines shut down and jobs went away, he traded in his hard hat for a beekeeping veil.
A lot of times underground, you're working in water and dark conditions, and at times it's miserable. This is not miserable. This is a really enjoyable job. I'm paying off a lot of my bills that we've had in the past that's built up over the years, and able to do things for my grandbabies and my family. See, here's the queen. See how much bigger she is?
Cyphers found his job through the Appalachian Beekeeping Collective, a nonprofit that teaches displaced workers and other low-income residents looking to earn extra income how to become beekeepers.
Shake it a little bit. You shake don't have to do it real hard, but go ahead and shake it.
After completing a free 5-week program, aspiring beekeepers are given bees, hives, and all the necessary supplies they need to get started. Expert beekeeper Mark Lilly is an educator with the collective.
In my previous job, I traveled a lot of these areas. So for the past 30 years, I've watched them slowly die. So you see the people now have like hopelessness. So if we can teach a family to maybe generate $3,000 to $5,000 of additional income, if you're only making $30,000, that's a huge improvement in your lifestyle.
It's time to get away from them.
Veteran Mike Davis has discovered the many other benefits of beekeeping.
It gives you something to look forward to on a daily basis. You're anticipating the growth of your hive. But I equate it even with my spiritual side. The bees are just not only calming, it's just like similar to dogs that other people have. I have that same affection for my bees.
And he says this is the ideal place for them.
This area of southern West Virginia is the largest forage in the world. We don't have pesticides, insecticides, because we don't have commercial farming. So we have the trees. We have a lot of water. The conditions are great for the bees.
And that translates into great-tasting honey, which is the end product of the nectar that the bees forage from some of the most diverse species of plants and flowers unique to the state. Terry Giles is with Appalachian Headwaters, which oversees the beekeeping collective.
I look here and I see what used to be a thriving railroad community has turned into a community with not a lot of options. This beekeeping collective that we are sponsoring is giving people options. But better yet, it's giving people hope for the future.
So what we're looking for here is a nice pattern.
With an eye to that future, the Appalachian Beekeeping Collective plans to expand its program to reach the next generation of beekeepers so they can help West Virginia thrive once again, this time with a more environmentally sustainable commodity.
She's beautiful. She is beautiful.
Julie Tabot, VOA News, Hinton, West Virginia.
A never-before-heard song by the late Queen frontman Freddie Mercury has just been released. The track, Time Waits for No One, was originally recorded in 1986 at London's Dominion Theater for the concept album of the musical Time with musician Dave Clark. We dug up this audio of Mercury and Clark having a conversation about their collaboration.
I remember when I first met David, I mean, it was like, I liked the fact that it was like on one-to-one basis.
Yeah, and I tried to get hold of Freddie 2 years ago, but he was on one of his world tours, and everybody said it would be impossible. And I was determined because I've always respected what his work, and a girlfriend of mine gave me his telephone number in Munich, where he was living at the time. And I phoned him, and...
But that's my girlfriend as well. Anyway.
Oh, shit. Sure.
But after having met him, he sort of said, I like the one-to-one approach. And I said, well, that's the way you got me. Because, I mean, he just sort of phoned me up and said, what would you like to do? Time.
Mercury died of AIDS-related pneumonia in 1991 at the age of 45. He was the subject of the uber-successful film Bohemian Rhapsody, which won actor Rami Malek an Academy Award. The film also won Oscars for Best Sound Editing, Best Sound Mixing, and Best Film Editing. You don't need me to tell you what's gone wrong. You know what's going on. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show. But you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for listening, and thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
After almost three decades, the United States reopened a permanent mission of the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, in Somalia. On June 17th in Mogadishu, USAID Administrator Mark Green said the United States is opening the mission in Somalia's capital because the people of Somalia and the leadership of Somalia have shown a commitment to pursuing a more citizen-centered, more resilient, and more self-reliant future. And at USAID, when we find leaders who are willing to take on tough choices and the reforms that are necessary to pursue self-reliance, then we want to walk with them along the way. And that is what opening a mission is all about. On June 17th, Administrator Green announced that the United States will provide nearly $185 million in additional humanitarian assistance for the people of Somalia to address life-threatening food insecurity and acute malnutrition, and deliver safe water and emergency health care services to people affected by ongoing conflict and prolonged drought. The United States is the largest donor of humanitarian assistance to Somalia, providing nearly $672 million since the start of fiscal year 2018. In his remarks at the opening of the mission, Administrator Green praised the government and people of Somalia for the strides they have made over the last several years. Reform efforts based on a sincere commitment to peace, citizen-responsive governance, and the expansion of economic opportunity have built a sense of optimism here and across the country that a brighter day does in fact lie ahead, he said. Administrator Green noted that Somalia continues to face great challenges and that its young democracy requires further nurturing. He called the elections, which are to be held next year, a historic opportunity for trying the principles of democratic representation, free and fair elections, and the peaceful transfer of power, turning that into practice. The establishment of the USAID mission in Mogadishu is an important milestone in deepening the U.S.-Somalia development partnership, declared Administrator Green. We're very proud to stand together and work with all of you towards a more stable, democratic, and prosperous future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm